Well, good morning, everybody. How's everybody doing this morning? Yeah, it's good to see you. It's good to be with you again. If you have a Bible with you this morning, we're going to be in Romans 12 again, looking at verses 3 through 8. So there's a scene in the movie Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, where, yeah, we got some Star Wars fans this morning, right? Go Star Wars. Where Yoda is training Luke Skywalker. At the end of New Hope, it comes to be clear that Luke has the power of the Force, but he's young in his apprehension of the Force, and so he has to be trained in order to hone in the Force. And he's told in a vision by Obi-Wan Kenobi to go to Dagobah to find this creature named Yoda, who will train him in the Force. So he goes on this quest to go find this guy, and as he comes to Dagobah, he crashes his plane. Dagobah is kind of this dark, swampy, creepy planet, and as he comes in, he loses control of his X-Wing fighter plane and goes down into a swamp. And so he climbs out, already discouraged that he's having to like deal with this disaster with this plane, but what else is he going to do but go find Yoda? So eventually he finds Yoda, and Yoda one day takes him and trains him right at the edge of the swamp where he crashed his plane. And so one of the things that Yoda has young Luke Skywalker doing is balancing on his hand. He's doing a handstand with one hand. He's balancing Yoda on his foot, and then he's moving stones with the Force to stack them on top of each other. Now, as he's doing this exercise, something happens in the swamp, and his plane goes fully under. It just submerged, and Luke sees that happen. He gets really discouraged. He gets really frustrated. He's distracted. He falls over. His stones fall over. And then he says, well, I'm never going to get out of here now, right? My X-Wing fighter plane is fully submerged. I'm stuck here forever. What in the world is going to happen? And then Yoda responds saying in his like Kermit the Frog voice, right? With his, you know, backwards sentences. He says, always with you, what cannot be done, right? Essentially saying, you always focus on the negative. You always focus on the things that are challenges. You always focus on things that seem to not be going well. And then Luke says, well, moving stones is one thing, but this is completely different. And then Yoda like snaps back at him. He goes, no, it's only different in your mind. You must unlearn what you have learned. Essentially saying, you need to think differently. You need to think differently. So Luke, deflated and discouraged, he says, fine, I'll give it a try. Meaning, I'm going to try and use the Force to lift this plane out of the swamp. And so he goes to the edge. He's trying to concentrate. He's trying to focus. He's trying to move the plane. And it seems like maybe there's some initial movement, but then it just goes right back under. And he says, I can't. It's too big. So he gives up. He walks away. Again, more deflated, more discouraged. And then Yoda slowly, calmly, nonchalantly goes to the edge, and he closes his eyes, and he reaches out his hand, and effortlessly, he moves this X-Wing fighter pilot or plane out of the swamp, moves it across the air, and sets it down gently right in front of Luke Skywalker. And Luke sees this and he goes, I can't believe this. And then Yoda says, this is why you failed. You failed not because of a lack of effort. He said you failed because of your thinking, because of the way in your mind you perceived your circumstances. Psychologists and educators have two terms to describe what's happening in this scene. Those two terms are a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. Anybody familiar with those terms? We've probably heard those before. In this scene, Luke Skywalker has a fixed mindset, where Yoda has a growth mindset. A growth mindset says or believes, I can always improve. I can always get better. I can always grow. I can always achieve new things. I can always keep taking on new challenges. And with enough effort, right thinking, and the right people around me, I can succeed at those things. A fixed mindset believes that there is a ceiling on your ability and skills. You can only grow so far, you can only work so hard, you can only achieve so much. And so it's thought, therefore, the overall success of an individual is less about your ability and it's more about your thinking, whether or not you have a growth mindset or a fixed mindset. And so the question for us this morning is, where do you have a fixed mindset? Specifically, in your spiritual life. Specifically, in your relationship with God. Meaning, where is God inviting you into something new? Where is God stretching you in your relationship with Him? And your initial response is, there's no way. I couldn't do that. I couldn't become that. I couldn't practice that. I couldn't, just no way. See, the assumption of the Bible is that God is always looking for you to participate with Him in His mission in the world. And sometimes that can feel scary. It can seem beyond your capacity. It can even feel like it's way outside your comfort zone. But the other assumption of the Bible is that wherever God calls you to engage with His mission in the world, He will also prepare you. He will empower you, and He will equip you for your participation in His work and mission in the world. Essentially, you could say it this way. The key to fully engaging in God's calling starts with your thinking. Engaging in God's calling starts with your thinking. Do you have a growth mindset in your relationship with God, or do you have a fixed mindset in your relationship with God? And so the question we have to ask is, where is your thinking hindering you from engaging? Where is your thinking hindering you from engaging? Essentially, where do you need to think differently? We're going to pick up our passage that we started with yesterday in Romans 12 and verse 3, but for context's sake, I'm going to read the first two verses as well. So let's jump back in Romans 12, starting in verse 1 and 2. This is what Paul writes. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the what? Renewing of your mind. Essentially, think differently. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. And so we said yesterday that chapter 12 marks a new section in Paul's letter to the Romans. And essentially, as he starts this new section, he's saying engaging in God's calling starts with your thinking, with the renewal of your mind. And you begin to see that explicitly in verse 3, because he goes on to say this in verse 3. For by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment, in accordance with the faith that God has distributed to each of you. Now, one of the objectives when we read and study the Bible is that we read for meaning. Essentially, what does this mean? This is a hermeneutical principle, right? Which, if you don't know what hermeneutics is, don't worry about it. It's a big, fancy, $50 theological word. But it's the study of the Bible in a way where we read for meaning. What does this mean? But we also read for application. So we read for meaning and application. One of the strategies we look for in meaning and application are repeated words. So when you see words in a passage repeated over and over, that's a clue to you that Paul is doing something with that word that is significant. And in Romans 12:3, the word think is used four times. We're going to read it again and see if you can pick out the four times that it's used. This is chapter 12, verse 3 again. For by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment, in accordance with the faith that God has distributed to each of you. Did you catch the four? You didn't? There's four there. How many of you saw two? Right. Nobody saw four? Yeah, that's a trick question. Because in English, the way that this is translated has the word think twice. In Greek, the Bible was originally written in Greek. It's actually there four times. And the way that translators translate it is such that it kind of smooths out. Because as you'll see, it's kind of clunky if you were to have it literally. But this is, we're going to nerd out for just a minute on Greek. Hopefully that's okay. If it's not, just endure the next few minutes and it'll be okay. This is verse 3 in Greek. And there are four words, bold and underlined. All of those words are the word think. In Greek, it's the word phronein. Say that with me, phronein. It's the word to think. It's a significant word that Paul uses in lots of his letters to mean something like really huge when it comes to understanding who you are in light of who God is. Now, in these four uses, the two that are in the middle look the same. Again, that's the word phronein. You can see they're identical. The first one and the fourth one have words attached to them, have another word attached to it, essentially pushing two words together to make a new word. So the first one is the word huperphronein. Huperphronein is how you would say it. It's a preposition. Huper means above, to think highly of something, high thinking or above thinking. The second word has the word so next to it, and so means safe or sound. Oftentimes it gets translated in this place, sound thinking, safe thinking, but it gets translated sober judgment. So if you were to translate this verse literally, the way that it reads here, it would be this. Don't overthink what you ought to think of yourself, but think of yourself in a sound thinking way, right? That's kind of clunky, right? So that's why they translate it a little bit differently to smooth it out. But as you can see, Paul really wants us to think about things in a certain way. He's really trying to emphasize that it's important about how we think of certain things. So the question is what? What is it that he wants us to think about? Why is he emphasizing this idea of thinking so much, and what does he want us to think about? He gives us three things as we move through this passage. The first is he wants you to think differently about yourself. He says, don't think too highly of yourself. He says, you should not think more highly of yourself than you ought. Anybody here guilty of that? Anybody here guilty of thinking too highly of yourself? Yeah, we got some people who are helping those. If not everybody is raising their hand right now, we have another problem. We're all a bunch of liars, right? Like, we all think way too highly of ourselves. If you believe that you are right all the time, you think too highly of yourself. Because there are plenty of times when you are wrong. If you can't stand losing, and every time you lose, you make up an excuse for why you lost, you probably think too highly of yourself. If you have this perception that all of your success is due to your own self-making, you probably think too highly of yourself. If you're hypercritical of other people, you probably think too highly of yourself. So one of the realities of pastoral ministry in 2020 was everybody had to go online, right? Everybody had to pivot how they did ministry, and somewhere along the way, everybody went online. And so what pastors were doing repeatedly were checking out what other churches were doing to try and figure out how are they navigating the pandemic, how are they navigating this shift, what are they doing? Nobody trained us in seminary. There was no pandemic 101 class for how to navigate a world shutting down. Everybody's scrambling. And so naturally, like everybody else, I'm starting to check out other churches online to see what they're doing, to see how they're navigating different things. And it was really interesting. I had no idea what I was doing. Nobody else in ministry had any idea what they were doing. Everybody was doing the best that they could. But every time I would hop on a church website to see how they were navigating preaching and worship services, I found this criticism. welling up in my heart to be like, oh, I can't believe they would do it that way, right? I can't believe they would try and do that. And I found myself just being hypercritical and critiquing anybody and everybody on the things that they were doing with no grace, all the while myself having zero clue what I was doing. I was thinking way too highly of myself. And there was one day I'm sitting watching a sermon. It was like the voice of God just was like, boom, I'm watching this sermon from this other church, and Brian, it was like the voice of God saying, Brian, like, what are you doing? Well, you need to be kind, you need to be gracious, and you need to think less of yourself. See, what Paul is talking about here is the theme of humility. He's not using the word, he doesn't use the word humility, but he's talking about being humble and not thinking too highly of yourself. Now, sometimes we think that humility is thinking less of ourselves or thinking down of ourselves or having a negative perception of ourselves, but true humility isn't necessarily thinking less of yourself in some disparaging way. It's embracing and knowing who exactly you are. It's to be honest with yourself, with your sin, with your weakness, with your need for God in your life, and at the same time, also being honest with yourself about how much you are loved by God. Did you know that? God thinks the world of you. Not because of what you've done, not because you're super impressive in your accomplishments, not because you're an amazing mom or an amazing dad or you've succeeded in business or you have all of these awards and accolades. He loves you because you're his, because he created you, because his dignity and his image is stamped on your life. You are his. He thinks the world of you. One pastor from the 19th century, Tyrone Edwards, said this. He said, true humility is not abject groveling or a self-despising spirit, but it's a right assessment of ourselves as God sees us. And God is over the moon about you. He loves you more than you could ever possibly imagine. And so Paul is inviting us to think differently about ourselves, to think rightly about ourselves, that we are people who oftentimes think too highly of ourselves. But it's a call and an invitation to rest in how God views us and how God sees us and how much God loves us, not because of what we've done, but simply because we're his. Engaging in God's calling starts with your thinking. Thinking rightly about yourself, but also thinking differently about to whom you belong. This is what Paul says in verse 4. He says, "For just as each of us has one body with many members, and these many members do not all have the same function, so in Christ we, though many, form one body, and each member belongs to all the others." One of Paul's common metaphors to describe the church is a human body. And in this metaphor, he's trying to show that your body is interconnected. Your body is interdependent. And in the same way that a human body is interdependent, the church as a body also needs to be interdependent. So when I turned 40, I've always been an athletic, active individual. When I turned, not 40, but 30, when I turned 30 almost a decade ago, I used to run all the time, train for half marathons, did four or five half marathons. I went out for a run one day, and I had this incredibly sharp pain in my knee. I could run about a mile. I was running 8-9 miles at a time at this point. Had this incredible sharp pain in my knee and was just so taken by it. Rested a couple days, iced it, stretched, went out for another run, started feeling good. Again, a mile in, it just hit. And for a whole summer, like, I couldn't run at all. Near the end of the summer, my wife's like, you really should go get this checked out. And I thought for sure I had, like, something internal in my knee that was broken, and I was going to need surgery, and it was going to be just this huge recovery process. So I go to the doctor, she checks me out, she asks me a few questions, and she's like, oh yeah, you know where your problem is. I'm like, yeah, it's right here in my knee. She's like, no, it's in your glute. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, you've got a weak butt. I was like, It's like, excuse me? What did you say? So you got a weak butt. See, you have this band that runs down the side of your leg. It's called your IT band. And if you have a weak butt, your IT band overcompensates and it pulls. Your IT band goes from your hip to your knee. And it pulls tight. And the place where you feel pain is at your knee. So I was thinking I needed to fix something in my knee, but the doctor was saying, no, you need to strengthen your glutes. And as you do that, you will find that it will loosen the tension on your IT band and you'll be able to run fine. So now I do squats all the time so I can make sure I don't have a weak butt. But the point is, your body is interconnected. Like when one thing hurts, it might not, like the thing might not be right there. It could be in some other part of your body. What Paul is doing here is he's talking about unity. In the same way he doesn't use the word humility, but he's talking about humility, he's talking here about unity, even though he's not using the word unity. And he's trying to show that we, as Christians, are called to live interdependent lives. We need one another more than we know. Because we live in a world that is hyper-individualistic. We live in a world that says, my responsibility is to care for myself and let everybody else figure their lives out on their own. And Paul's saying, yeah, I guess you could do that, but there's another way to live. And maybe even a better way to live. Because the reality is we will all hit a point where we need something. We will have a financial need. We will have a physical need. We will have an emotional need. And the question is, do you have people in your life who will support you and come around you in your time of need? Because everybody, somewhere along the way, will be in need. And in the book of Acts, there's this beautiful picture of what it looks like for the church to be one, for the church to be united together. You read this. This is Acts 4, verse 32. All the believers, right, the church was just born. Jesus had raised from the dead, ascended to the Father. The Holy Spirit came. Huge conversions in Jerusalem. People were gathering together. And it says all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And God's grace was so powerfully at work among them all that there was no needy persons among them. He says, for from time to time, those who owned land or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet and distributed it to anyone who had need. See, Paul is saying that our reality is that this is what it means to be a Christian, that we share what we have, to view your life not so much as like, this is mine, but what I have is, this belongs to us. This is ours, and we belong to each other. The language that the New Testament uses to describe this is that of a family. Family language. Oftentimes at Fort, we talk about the Fort family, right? And oftentimes when we come up here, we're engaging with each other in a unique way. It's almost like if we could do this all the time, wouldn't that be amazing, right? The reality is you have that at your home. Something about Fort that just makes it really easy to do that. But you have that at home, in your church community, if you go to a church that believes this and values this. Sometimes, like, that family imagery brings baggage for people, but the church is supposed to be a body of people that can reshape and reimagine what it means to be a family. And as we live caring for one another, being united, we bear witness to the world for what it means to belong to each other. So Paul is inviting us to think differently about ourselves, to think differently about to whom you belong, and then to think differently about what you have to contribute. He goes on to say this in verse 6. We have different gifts according to the grace given to each of us. If your gift is prophesying, then prophesy in accordance with your faith. If it's serving, then serve. If it's teaching, then teach. If it's to encourage, then give encouragement. If it is giving, then give generously. If it is to lead, do it diligently. If it's to show mercy, do it cheerfully. See, part of Paul's metaphor here is that each part of the body has a unique purpose. Ears have different function than a nose, which has different function than a hand, which has different function than a knee, which has a different function than a foot. We all have a different function. We all have a unique part to play, which means each person has a unique purpose in the overall body. And as a whole, if you're not operating with your unique gifting in your unique purpose, we are missing out and we are actually in deficit. And this is where I think most people have a fixed mindset in their spiritual lives. They have this mindset of either I can't, or what I have isn't good enough, or it actually doesn't do anything. Because sometimes we look at what we have to give, or we look at the unique way that God has gifted us, and we think to ourselves, well, it's insignificant. It's meaningless. It's really not going to move the needle. It's not going to impact somebody's life. It's not going to do anything significant at all. And we think what we have to give is too small. But sometimes it's the smallest things that make the biggest impact. So this was a couple years ago. I was pulling out of our driveway to go to work for that day. I was in my Honda Accord. I put it in reverse. I backed out of the driveway, and then I went to go put my car in drive so I could go, and I realized the button on my shifter was missing. It just wasn't there, which was so perplexing, because 10 seconds earlier, it was there. I know that it was there because I pushed it to put my car in reverse. So naturally, logically, I thought it has to be somewhere in the car. I have no idea how this happened. So I start to like scour the car. You can see it's missing. And then I found it underneath my seat. And I was like, that's weird. And so it had broken off. So I put it back in. I just pushed it. I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this, but I got to go to work. Does it still work? I put it back in and it pushed. So I pushed it in. I put it in drive. And as I went, again, I looked down and it was gone. And I was like, so, and then I went to go, like, now I'm on the street, and I went to go pull over, but I'm like, I can't pull over, because I can't put it in park. So I had, like, literally in the middle of the street, I put on the brake, found it, and, like, put it back in, pulled over, parked, and I called my wife. I was like, hey, so here's what you need to know is happening with our car right now. Like, you can't lose the button, all right? You just need to know, if you end up driving this car, whether it's later today or tomorrow, you can't lose the button, because if we lose the button, we can't drive the car. Never once in the however many years having this car did I ever think about that button. I took it for granted. It was just there. Turns out, it's a really vital part of your car, right? Because if it's not there, you can't drive. It probably makes up 0.1% of the overall functionality of the car, but it's a wildly important part. Some of the smallest things are the most important things. Some of the smallest, seemingly insignificant things actually have the biggest impact. And so you may think to yourself, well, what I have to give is small and insignificant. But God's saying, no. It is vital to the overall working of the body. And the unique thing about the way that God invites us, right? Because what we're saying is that engaging in God's calling starts with your thinking. One of the realities is that God doesn't necessarily need us, right? He doesn't need us, but he chooses to use us. And so the question for you is, what do you have? What has God given you? How is God calling you to engage in his mission in the world? And you know what the end result, the result that God wants for you in your engagement with him isn't results. He's not after results. What he really wants is relationship. So when my oldest daughter was 2 years old, one of the things I've always done with my kids is anytime I'm working in the kitchen and they say, can I help? I have always said, yes, you can. Because it's just a way for them to come alongside me and do something with me. So one day my wife was slow to get up in the morning. We had our two-year-old. She was pregnant with our second and just, you know, had a hard night and so was sleeping in and said, hey, let's make breakfast for mom. Let's make her an omelet. And Kate just says, hey, can I help? And I say, sure. She's 2 years old at this time. So I put her up on the counter and we start to get eggs and I'm showing her how to crack an egg. You tap the egg, you pull it apart. I give her an egg. She holds it over the bowl and she just squeezes it and just breaks the egg. And I'm like, okay, that's not how you do that, but that's okay, right? And so now I'm trying to turn to the sink to get something to wipe up her hand. And she sees that what we're going to do is we're going to put shredded cheese in this omelet, and it's in a bag. She sees the cheese with her eggy hand. She just pushes it into the cheese to get cheese and starts to eat it. I'm like, no, you can't eat eggy cheese. And so now, like, I move her from the counter to the ground to try and clean up this mess. And as we're doing that, cheese falls on the ground. And our dog, Charlie, is now running around having a heyday eating up the cheese. And Kate sees this, and she laughs, and she takes her eggy, cheesy hand and wipes her hair out of her face. And now I've got to, like, figure out how to clean up the mess on the counter, clean up the mess on the floor, clean up the mess on her face. And I'm doing all of this, and it's starting to feel chaotic. And I just pause, and I look back, and she has this huge smile on her face, and she goes, I'm helping. I'm like, you are, sweetie. You are helping more than you know. Having her work alongside me, wildly inefficient. Wildly inefficient. Made more mess, took longer, but at the end of the day, it wasn't about our results. It was about the relationship. It was about the relationship that I was building with her and the connection that we could have. See, God calls you to have a growth mindset that it's not about performing for him or anybody else. It's about entering into relationship with him, using the gifts that he has called you to do, to think differently about the impact that you can make. And it may not be huge, wild, and amazing, but that's okay because it's not about it being huge, wild, and amazing. It's about building relationship with him, building relationship with other people, and fully stepping in to who God has made you to be. So may you see that God has gifted you in unique ways. May you see yourself as God sees you. And may you see that the church needs you. And may you contribute wholeheartedly with whatever God has gifted you